Let me go ahead and turn things over to Kate Garuffy to officially get us started. Kate.
Thank you very much, Jean. Before I introduce the presenters, I want to welcome everybody and give you a brief overview of the design and construction issues at hazardous waste sites webinar series, as well as some of our other in-person symposium events. So as Jean mentioned before, this webinar series is being put on and co-sponsored by EPA and the Society of American Military Engineers, or SAMMEE. We've been collaborating with SAMMEE over the last 7 years to deliver a number of symposium events that I'll talk about briefly, as well as this new webinar series. As you can see from the slide, the objectives of the EPA and SAMMEE collaboration is to facilitate open and frank communication amongst professionals from both the public and private sectors regarding design and construction issues at hazardous waste sites. That includes effective methods for designing projects, delivering projects, acquisition strategies, project management, lessons learned. We also want to provide a varied number of forums for presenters to describe current practices and approaches and enhance the communication networks and promote continued discussion and dialogue as the area of design and construction at hazardous waste sites continues to evolve. As I alluded to before, EPA and SAMMEE have a number of events. Each year we put on two symposium events, one in Philadelphia and one in Denver. The 13th delivery of the DCHWS West East Symposium is scheduled for April 1st through 3rd of this year, so in a couple of weeks. And we have the 5th delivery of its sister symposium in Denver scheduled for the last week of October 2020. The West Symposium does not have an agenda or call for abstracts out yet. Please keep your eyes open. That will be coming out in the early summer months. In addition, we have a DCHWS seminar series that includes webinars, and we have an in-person RA management training that we'll be putting on later in the fall. So for the seminar series, we have 8 to 10 webinars planned in fiscal year 2020. I believe this is the 5th or 6th webinar. I can't remember off the top of my head. We have a number of presentations or webinars that are going to be done in the following months, and I will announce those and the titles on the next slide. In addition, as I alluded to before, we have an in-person construction management training scheduled for the fall of 2020. It will be a 2-day training. So keep your eyes open there in terms of when registration opens and the event is announced with an agenda. So we have two webinars that are scheduled, one for April and one for May, in the area of design and construction. Two very different webinars from what you're seeing today, but really, again, design and construction issues at hazardous waste sites. The webinar on April 6th, the registration is open, and you can click directly on that link and register. We will be opening the May webinar in late March. So before I hand it over to Gary and Abe, I'd like to introduce them. We have the two presenters from CDM Smith. The first presenter is Gary Hazen. Gary is a principal environmental engineer at CDM Smith with 25 years of professional experience in remediation of hazardous waste sites and cost estimating supporting remediation. He is the current president of the Kansas City section of the Association for Advancement of Cost Engineering International. Our second presenter is Abe Sanavne from CDM Smith as well. He's a civil engineer at CDM Smith with 15 years of professional experience in remediation of hazardous waste sites and cost estimation, supporting remediation, civil construction, as well as military construction, MILCON-type projects. So Gary and Abe, if you guys are ready, I'm going to turn it over to you for the technical part of our presentation. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, and we are ready. So as Kate and Jean mentioned, the topic for this presentation is reducing cost risk and remedial action budgets using supplemental cost estimating analyses. And this, again, is a deeper dive from the original presentation that was given in November 2018 in Denver, Colorado for the DCHWS West Conference. The overview today in terms of the background leading up to this deeper dive is we're going to provide an introduction to remedial action cost estimates. What are remedy selection cost estimates, both from how EPA cost estimating guidance affecting feasibility studies and records of decision influence that, what the limitations are of remedy selection cost estimates, potential consequences and impacts to remedial action implementation from cost risks that aren't addressed as part of the remedy selection cost estimates. Also going to talk a little bit about enhancement of remedy selection cost estimates, and that's really the focus, establishing a selected remedy budget and refining that budget based on project-specific funding information. So what is a remedy selection cost estimate? Many of you that are involved in CERCLA remedial action projects are aware that when we implement a remedial action, it's based on a record of decision, which was informed by a feasibility study. So in terms of the cost estimates that support this, you first develop alternative cost estimates during the feasibility study. So you have a range of options. You provide a cost estimate for that. In turn, one of those alternatives or more, depending on the record of decision, are selected and adapted as the selected remedy. And so the cost estimates developed as the feasibility study for that alternative would be incorporated into the record of decision. And then from that, the remedy selection cost estimates are used as the starting basis for establishing remedial action budgets. Not always, but usually those budgets are informed from the record of decision cost estimates for the selected remedy. And as pointed out in the with the red triangle, in some or if not many cases, the same estimate is used for all three without adjustment. One thing I'll point out, and it's on the right, is EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers have developed guidance related to developing and documenting cost estimates during the feasibility study. So presumably, all three of these estimates at least incorporate the minimum recommended requirements indicated in that guidance. So a little bit about feasibility study cost estimating guidance. And the focus is evaluation and comparison of alternatives for remedy selection. And because of that, the level of alternative scope definition is typically pretty low, you know, 1 to 15%. Sometimes it's referred to as a conceptual design, but in reality, it's a concept for an alternative that may be very flexible in terms of what is actually implemented during remedial design and remedial action. It also uses simplified methodology in estimating assumptions, and I can touch on a few examples, but for instance, you don't necessarily look at inflation within a feasibility study cost estimate. The other thing is that it is order of magnitude estimates. Per the guidance, you would expect plus 50 to minus 30% of actual cost, meaning that the cost as presented for an alternative could be as much as 50% higher or as low as 30% lower than what the actual cost may be. And to relate this to the Association for the Advancement of Cost Engineering Recommended Practices, as well as ASTM methods, those are typically a class four estimate. So again, order of magnitude. That wide accuracy range is there primarily due to the methodology. That's an important point, is that's not really intended to account for project uncertainties or risks. That is just simply due to the methodology you're using. You can expect that that level of accuracy range for the estimate that's provided. With respect to an EPA record of decision cost estimate and the guidance related to it, when you read the ROD guidance, it's typically minimal differences from the cost estimating guidance. It indicates, you know, a similar level or same level of detail and methodology as an FS cost estimate. It does recommend a few adjustments. For instance, if the cost estimate was prepared many years back for the feasibility study and the record of decision and the remedy selection is several years later, it does recommend escalating or inflating those costs to the new base year, meaning if they were prepared, for instance, in 2015 and now it's 2020, you would want to adjust the cost to be representative of 2020. However, that's really the only adjustments that it specifically indicates. And then when you get to remedial design and remedial action, there is EPA's remedial design remedial action handbook. And it's really a shift to a different methodology. When you do the higher level class estimates, class four or five that are order of magnitude, those are really more parametric approaches, what some people refer to as a top-down approach. When you get to remedial design and remedial action, you do a really detailed unit cost development, where you look at individual, you know, crews, equipment, labor, et cetera. And that's typically referred to as a bottom-up estimate. So those serve as the basis for all future stages of estimates and can inform the independent government cost estimate that is established for the remedial action. That, in turn, is often used for budgeting at later phases prior to implementation. The point of that is there is a lot more information that's incorporated when you do a lower class estimate as part of, you know, remedial design. Remedial action includes, you know, contract costs, escalation, meaning inflation to the midpoint of construction, certain allowances and contingencies that the FS guidance does not look at. And we have a graph on the right. This comes from EPA's guidance for documenting feasibility study cost estimates. And the important thing to show is that the accuracy level of the estimate narrows as you go from the feasibility study, which it shows screen of alternatives and detailed analysis of alternatives, to design and remedial action complete. And part of the reason that that accuracy range can narrow is the level of project definition, meaning how well defined the scope of the alternative or the remedy is. And you can see it goes from low to high. So that's part of the reason you can narrow the accuracy range. So what are limitations of a remedy selection cost estimate for RA budgeting? Well, you know, I mentioned it in the prior slides, a low level of alternative scope definition. Part of that has to do with simplified work activities, you know, because again, we're just trying to compare alternatives in a feasibility study, not necessarily lay out all activities that would be performed to implement that remedy. You use simplified quantities typically. A lot of times we focus on the quantity drivers related to simplified alternative scope, meaning you don't necessarily have to cost every element of a alternative to meet the expected accuracy for comparing alternatives. If you focus on those elements that are either have a large quantity or a large unit cost or both, that typically will get you pretty close in terms of the accuracy that's required to compare alternatives. So we don't necessarily do that on a feasibility study. And then the limited analysis of project uncertainties and risks. You know, most feasibility studies, you know, per the guidance, you would do a sensitivity analysis, which looks at what do changes in a unit cost or a unit quantity do in terms of affecting the overall cost of an alternative. But it's typically limited to that and doesn't look at what are the uncertainties and risks associated with an alternative or a project. The other thing is simplified cost approaches from the guidance. You know, when we do remedial action budgeting from a remedy selection cost estimate and a ROD, you know, things such as contingency, which is meant to address unforeseen conditions or, unforeseen conditions, and as well as professional technical services costs, which include things such as remedial design, construction management, technical support. Those are based on rules of thumb, which EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers have developed from empirical data, but they are rules of thumb. They don't necessarily serve every unique circumstance. Sometimes the duration of construction or ideal funding is based on simplified assumptions. For instance, the feasibility study guidance indicates you can use a year zero assumption for capital costs. What in essence you're saying is even though construction may happen over many years, that you would just assume for purposes of a present value analysis that it occurs all in the first year or year zero. As I think many know, that's not necessarily reality. It doesn't affect the purpose, which is present value analysis. It's conservative, but it does affect things when you look at budgeting. And there's also no consideration typically of funding limitations, you know, for instance, partial funding spread out over time or a delayed implementation of remedial action because of funding delays. Present value analysis, which is, in simple terms, putting money in a bank that earns interest to pay for something later. The guidance indicates a 7% real discount rate based on current or today's dollars for that analysis, regardless of how you fund that. And again, for comparing alternatives, it does make some sense because some alternatives may not spread costs over time like others, but from a real-world economic standpoint, most projects don't have an interest-bearing account that's earning that interest. So, again, if you're budgeting, that's something you would want to consider. And then I think I mentioned it in a couple slides prior, escalation and inflation. So taking account, increased interest over time in terms of inflation, typically is not considered, as well as appreciation or depreciation. For instance, if you buy equipment and it loses value over time, we typically don't account for that in a feasibility study as well. We really use a constant dollar analysis, which is today's dollars looking over time. And the takeaway from that is that these estimates are preliminary and simplified with respect to remedial action considerations. And if you read that guidance, it says specifically in the scope that it's not meant to be used for RA budgeting without adjustments. One important thing about remedial action budgeting is stakeholder perspectives. Depending on what party you are and how you're using that funding based on your perspective, it can differ on how you would budget the project. So one consideration is funding streams. Not all remedial action projects are funded the same way. Some, and the preferred, I think, approach from the CERCLA or MCP standpoint is that that the parties that cause the contamination provide the funding for the implementation of the remedy. So that would be through enforcement settlements with potentially responsible parties. But there are other ways that it's funded. There can be settlements or court orders that provide a trust that holds those funds on behalf of the government to implement a remedy, and that could be a third party holding that. You can also have direct congressional or legislative appropriations, again, when there's no party that can that fund that due to insolvency or other reasons. Sometimes the taxpayers pay through that through appropriations through their taxes through Congress or a legislator. The other thing is funding obligations. Again, depending on which party you are, you're going to look at the funding stream a little differently. For the federal government, if they're in fund lead, which means that the federal government is the lead agency is funding this, they have to pay 90% of the capital costs, but no O&M costs in most cases. Conversely, if you're a support agency, such as a state, under a fund lead project, then the obligation is 10% of capital costs, but 100% of the O&M costs in most cases. And then when you talk about other parties involved, for instance, potentially responsible parties, sometimes they have to pay up to 100% of both the capital and the O&M costs, and that can also depend on how many parties are involved and whether there's allocation, which means they're splitting some of the costs depending on their degree of responsibility for the contamination. And then there's third-party trusts, other trusts that don't have direct obligations other than to be good stewards of the funds received to implement the remedy. And again, the key takeaway is that cost uncertainty and risk focus and tolerance may differ depending on the stakeholders due to the funding streams and obligations. What are some of the potential consequences and impacts to implementation from unaddressed cost uncertainties? Well, you can have scope changes. For instance, when you have enforcement settlements from the parties or third-party trusts or appropriations, there may be reasons because of that funding stream that there has to be changes because that money can't come when it's needed to implement the remedy and the ROD. And sometimes in the worst cases, that can lead to, a post record of decision change, which is not desired. You can have schedule impacts or changes. Where you have delay signing of records of decisions, you can have state Superfund contracts, which are the agreements between the federal agency and the support agency, meaning the state in implementing a remedy, or hiccups in the enforcement settlements related to impacts related to the schedule because of the funding streams. You can also have delay or phase funding from the National Risk-Based Priority Panel, which funds projects from congressional appropriations, or you can have delays and disputes and cost allocations between various responsible party groups. So that can be an impact from cost uncertainties that are unaddressed. And then participation changes. Sometimes these projects have third parties implementing portions around these. A good example is institutional controls where a county or local government, NGO or an advocacy group may be doing part of it. Sometimes you can have things like wetlands restoration or other things that are done by third parties. So if they don't have that funding, they can have challenges in participating. And the key takeaway here is that you can take simple measures during RA budgeting early in the process, often before remedial design, remedial action, to help reduce, though not necessarily eliminate, those potential impacts or consequences, as compared to using a record of decision remedy selection cost estimate for funding remedial action. So a little bit in terms of supplemental cost analyses, these are really simple measures that you can take to improve projected costs from what was documented in the ROD as the cost for implementing a remedy when you create that remedial action budget and the independent government cost estimate, especially if you do it prior to the remedial design process. There are a number of different types of supplemental analyses you can use. We list a few here: present value analyses, future value analyses, which take into account inflation, sensitivity analyses, which I mentioned before, and one that we'll talk about later, which is cost estimate risk analyses. And then there's additionally ones that you can refine the remedial action budgets on based on specific funding implementation information, meaning knowing your funding stream and when it will come. You can use all those tools that indicated prior to this, plus cash flow analyses and alternative funding scenario analyses. The key takeaway is that each of these have pertinent guidance and standards, and that you should engage cost estimating professionals for development of these. One point about this is this was really the prior presentation in 2018, so some of these tools we won't talk about today. Others we are going to do a little bit of a deeper dive on. So I guess at this point, I'm going to stop for EPA's on moderation.
So I'll just remind everybody that that Q&A window is available in the lower corner if you have any questions or comments. If you don't have any questions, go ahead and type that on into the Q&A window if you're ready for us to carry on and you feel fully comfortable with this background material. I'll look for a few comments either indicating you're ready, there are no questions, let's carry on, keep going, or we can pause here. But it looks like, Gary, it looks like everybody has no questions and you can keep going.
Great, thank you, Jean. So, the purpose of the presentation today is to do a deeper dive into these supplemental analysis tools that were previously presented. And so one of the things that we wanted to do is focus on a little more about what happens after the initial record of decision selected remedy is used for budgeting, whether it's adjusted or not adjusted. The point of it is even though a budget may have been established, EPA and other federal agencies implementing remedial action often and do, review that budget, update it. They need to inform managers or others that there may be needs to adjust that budget, especially if it's congressionally appropriated. It's a really big deal for federal agencies to give advance notice if possible. So the point is that there is value in confirming that the budget is still sufficient when you get into the initial phases of remedial design after a remedy is selected. The level of scope definition is still relatively low, but sometimes you have new information leading to changes in scope that you can anticipate. The scope itself may have changed. It may still be consistent with the record of decision. It may be a slightly different scope. Sometimes you need, when that scope hasn't changed, to better define the quantities for that scope activity. Sometimes you have a new project team is interpreting the scope of those activities in the record of decision, and they're developing the remedial design and may have thought about the meeting the record of decision requirements in a slightly different way than the team that was involved in doing the feasibility study and the record of decision. And because of that, it is really a good idea and can be helpful to either reaffirm or re-baseline those remedial action budgets when you get to this early phase of remedial design. And what's particularly helpful is if you have a basis of estimate document, which we'll talk about later in this presentation, to look at those assumptions. So we've listed two tools here in the first two sub-bullets of the second bullet. One is a cost comparison table, and the other is a cost estimate risk analysis. I will point out that one is a little more reactive in terms of its nature, and one's a little more proactive. I'll explain that in a minute. The cost comparison table is really a superficial analysis focusing on changes in the scope of quantities between the feasibility slash record of decision and those preliminary remedial action cost estimates are developed during remedial design. So in a way, this is reactive in that you're looking back at how the changes were affected in terms of scope or quantities, and that how that impacts the budget that was already produced. The cost estimate risk analysis approach is an in-depth analysis, and it has value in that it addresses project uncertainties and risks affecting RA budgeting. As mentioned in the prior slides, often that's not accounted for in feasibility study alternatives and analysis of them. And so this is a little bit more of a proactive approach in that you're accounting for things that haven't already been evaluated either in the alternative or in the initial phases of remedial design. And in that respect, it's a little more proactive. There are other supplemental analysis tools that can be used to enhance these budgets. But for this particular presentation, we're not going to get into those today. The key takeaway is that you know, those budgets that you established at the time of remedy selection or prior to should be reevaluated with these tools during the initial phases of remedial design to confirm that the budgets are still adequate. And so at this point, I'm going to turn it over to my co-presenter, Abhay Sanavne, who's going to talk about the analysis tool of a cost comparison table.
Thank you, Gary. Moving on to the supplemental analysis tools, the first tool that we'll be discussing here is the cost comparison tables. cost comparison table, as Gary mentioned in the previous slide, are simple numerical comparisons of scope and estimated cost, done typically during the preliminary RA cost estimate by comparing it to the ROD selected remedy cost estimate. These comparisons between the RA and the ROD cost estimates help in identifying missing or changed scope, differing quantities, and unit costs. Once identified, these factors help in understanding the overall cost impact of the project. These comparisons are ideal for lesser developed cost estimates that preclude more in-depth cost analysis like SERA, that is, the cost estimate risk analysis, as well as a basis of estimate document for one or both the estimates can greatly aid in comparison. Both SERA and BOE document will be addressed further in the presentation. The first case study, in all we'll be presenting four case studies. So the first case study we are looking at is for the East Fork Nine Mile Creek Waste Consolidation Area located in Bunker Hill Mining and Metallurgical Complex Superfund site in Idaho. A quick background of the site is the CERCLA enforcement is being implemented by the Coeur d'Alene Custodial and Work Trust, which includes development of a repository within the consolidation area. The site is very large and complex with many different areas and subsites. Due to the size and complexity of the site, and because it would be impractical to develop these site-specific conceptual designs, the focused feasibility study, the FFS, employed a cost estimate approach of using typical conceptual design, i.e. TCD. As a result of this TCD approach, the FFS and the ROD cost estimate do not consider location-specific considerations, and unit costs are developed for one standard size design. The figure on the right shows a typical conceptual design for a waste consolidation area above flood level. This TCD is pertinent to this cost comparison case study. We will see this play out in our comparison, which required rock coring and construction of buttresses. This slide shows how the approach for TCDs actually played out when we got into the remedial design for the waste consolidation area. As mentioned previously, the TCD used for waste consolidation area was based on one standardized design, size. In this case, the TCD assumed a 1 acre consolidation area with an approximate capacity of 40,000 cubic yards. Now compare that to the waste consolidation area which is designed. The designed waste consolidation area actually required approximately 23 acres and a 1 million cubic yard capacity repository. So the key takeaway is there are very different extents and capacities for the waste consolidation area between the ROD and the RD. Comparisons between unit costs from the ROD, that is around 1470, and RD, you know, it's around 17.4 per cubic yard, as apples and oranges. This slide shows the cost comparison on the ROD cost on the left versus the RD cost during the 60% design phase. The key takeaway from this slide is that we have highlighted with purple arrows the cost elements from the RD that were not considered in the TCD unit cost and derivations, which are mob, demob, general conditions, clearing, grubbing, excavate, quarry, rock, construction of buttresses, installations, drainage swales, and improved access roads. Now, for instance, if you look, excavate, quarry, rock, and construction of buttresses, these two, account alone adds up to around approximately $4 million in RD cost, or which is 20% of the overall RA planning cost estimate. Two main points. If you look at the direct cost with no contingency, the ROD is underestimated by approximately $3.5 million. This shows that the use of TCD cost approach was underestimating costs due to simplified approach. However, the ROD cost assumed a contingency of close to 70% of direct cost. Therefore, when you look at total construction costs, and the higher markup resulted in the ROD estimate being about $2.8 million higher than the 60% RA planning estimate. So the key takeaway is simplified conceptual design approaches during the FS ROD stage alone with higher contingency percentage based on site-specific knowledge can avoid a gross underestimate of cost for RA budgeting ROD. So moving on, the second case study is for the surface contamination remedial design at the Captain Jack Superfund site in Colorado. A quick site background is that the CERCLA enforcement was implemented by the state of Colorado, CDPHE, as the lead agency and EPA as the supporting agency for the site. The selected remedy and the ROD included excavation and placement of waste into three on-site repositories, amending waste material, surface water diversion, and access controls. In addition, the ROD specifically stated that a site feature called a Big Five waste rock dump will be capped in place, but no specific approach for capping or cost was included in the ROD. This feature, Big Five waste rock dump, is pertinent to this cost comparison case study. So this is the cost comparison on the ROD cost versus the RA cost during the 30% design phase. This simple comparison highlights gross underestimation of the ROD cost when compared to the the 30% hardy cost. If you look at the total cost for the repository, for the site, capping and reclamation, for the rod we had 76,000, and for the 30% RD we had almost $212,000. There is approximately 275% increase in the cost. So the key drivers that were pushing the cost that high are kind of highlighted in the yellow. As mentioned earlier, the rod did not specify a type of cover system for the Big Five mine dump. Therefore, during the remedial design, three different cover options were considered and evaluated based on effectiveness, implementability, related cost, and durability of the cover system. Based on this evaluation, a simple soil cover was selected for the Big Five mine dump. After the selection of a cover type, additional assessments were performed for geotechnical stability, and it was quickly realized that additional slope reinforcement or slope stabilization measures would be required. Therefore, following four options were evaluated. First one was use of geogrid reinforcement. Second was regrading the dump to a stable 3-to-1 slope. And the next two options were construction of a retaining wall with differing configurations. To address the geotechnical stability option two was selected based on technical considerations. As you can see, the cost for implementing option two was close to $340K, which was in addition to the cost of cover selected. So these costs were not accounted for in the rod cost estimate. Now going back to the comparison tables, as mentioned previously, there was an approximately 275% increase in the cost for capping, capping and reclamation during the 30% RD, which jumped from $76,000 to $212,000. But as the design progressed, which included the placement of a simple soil cover and implementing additional geotechnical stability measures for the Big Five waste rock dump, there was an approximately 620% increase in the cost for capping and reclamation during the 100% design or RD cost estimate, which is a jump from was close to $478,000. So the key takeaway is cost elements reflecting the scope were not accounted for in the rod estimate. And if the rod cost estimate were to be used for RA budgeting, then it would have resulted in a gross underestimation. So moving on to the case study three, the third case study is for the groundwater PCE plume treatment system at the Bountiful OU2 site in Bountiful, Utah. A quick background, site background, is that the selected remedy for OU2 addresses the source of PCE contamination and a groundwater plume eliminating from the property known as Bountiful Family Cleaners. The major components for the selected remedy for OU2 include PCE source area cleanup and hydraulic containment. Various technologies that were used for the RA includes ICs, alternative drinking water supply, enhanced aerobic bioremediation, SVE excavation of source area, groundwater extraction of injection wells, and monitoring and hydro reviews. And on the right, you can see where the resource area that is highlighted in yellow. The blue encompasses a tank form, and the red is kind of the outside boundary of the OU2. And on the west of the tank field, there's an open field. So just keep this map in mind, you know, because we will be discussing it further, or I'll be referencing that further. So treatment components like siting the treatment building itself, the site of the treatment building, yard piping, installation of extraction wells are pertinent to this cost comparison case studies. So this is the cost comparison on the FS cost estimate versus the RA cost estimate. One thing you would know that the FS was done back in 2006, and then the RA cost comparison was done in 2009. And you remember Gary had mentioned earlier that, you know, escalation could be included for the comparison, and for this comparison, escalation was included, meaning the FS 2006 costs were escalated to 2009 costs for comparison purposes. So this simple comparison highlights, you know, gross underestimation of FS costs when compared to the RA cost, which resulted in an approximately 225% increase in the total cost when you compare the FS versus the RA. The key cost drivers are highlighted in yellow and will be used for further in the comparison. So going back to the site background, so this site had a very big big PCE plume ranging from, if you remember the site layout, you have a source area and a huge field on the west. So this site had a very big PCE plume in terms of horizontal extent, and a very complicated plume in terms of vertical profile, which extended through multiple formations, including a confined aquifer, which made it difficult to map the plume itself. Thus, due to these factors or uncertainties, the scope of implementing the remedial action changed considerably. As you can see, there was a considerable increase in the cost during the RA as compared to the FS, was mainly due to the design and construction of a larger treatment system building that was required, and increased earthwork and yard piping from extraction wells to the treatment building to capture the expanded horizontal extent of the plume. Similarly, based on the factors that I discussed earlier in the previous slide and uncertainty in the scope of implementing remedial action, additional distance determined during the RD was approximately 4,900 linear feet of earthwork in the yard piping. And these costs were not captured in the FS. So the key takeaway is, given uncertainties regarding groundwater treatment, additional contingencies should be accounted for in the raw estimate if used for RA budgeting. So moving on to the fourth case study. The fourth case study is about the OU1 portion of Gilchrist Mine Superfund site, which is the primary mine disturbance area, the OU1 portion. A quick site background for the site is that the circular enforcement is being implemented by EPA Region 8 as the lead agency, and the state of South Dakota as a supporting agency. The selected remedy focuses on the primary mine disturbance area and reducing the production of ARD collected from treatment through remediation of contaminated sources such as mine-based exposed acid rock drainage and sludge. The estimated volume of sludge at the site is approximately 17 million gallons, and 5 million cubic yards of spent ore and contaminated soil material that was to be remediated. The selected remedy was modified via an ESD, that is explanation of significant differences to the ROD, which included on-site consolidation of ARD and water treatment plant sludge within an open-line impoundment. Originally, the selected remedy used an existing open pit for this purposes. The RA for OU1 has been partially implemented and was administered by the Corps of Engineers, Omaha District. This is the cost comparison table that was developed for the purposes of an ESD that was done to the ROD. As I mentioned earlier, originally the consolidation of ARD and water treatment plant sludge was to be done in an open pit, but as part of a technical consideration for ESD, it was determined that it couldn't be stored in an open pit due to potential impacts to the groundwater. Thus, the consolidation was shifted to an open-lined impoundment, and the open pit was to be backfilled and capped. The cost comparison between the modified remedy and the ROD remedy shows this technical shift in the scope, and it is reflected in the increased capital cost from 64 million to almost 87 million, but decreased the annual O&M cost because of increased remedy that would be performed at the site. So the key takeaway is, although the cost comparison table is for the purposes of an ESD, this was prepared during the preliminary phase of RD and was considered in part of doing the RA busting using enforcement settlement funds.
At this point, I think we were going to pause for any questions with EPA moderators.
Yeah, we did have a question that came in just regarding EPA and updating cost estimates. Do you have any sense how frequently EPA is getting or requesting these types of updated cost estimates?
I guess I'll speak from my experience. I have a very narrow window, of course. Even though I work in many EPA regions, I don't work on every project. I would say that there is an increased focus on scrutinizing budgets just in general, just due to, the fact that a lot of times taxpayer funding is used to implement these remedies. So there has been increased interest in project to project on, looking at ways to improve knowledge about, the cost of a remedy and often budgets. Sometimes that comes during public comment meetings, whether it's during the proposed plan phase or just during fact meetings that EPA or other agencies have with the public. So I think in general there's increased interest in this, but I can't say how often with the universe of projects given. I only have a very narrow view with what I work on.
Okay.
Did that answer the question?
I think so, but if that doesn't, feel free to go ahead and chime back in with a written clarification. So I appreciate that response. Our next question here is getting into the optional work. One of the participants wanted to know how optional work and costs are addressed or associated in your cost estimates.
So it's an interesting point because optional work is a function of a contract. It's meaning work that may or may not be implemented. Typically, federal agencies under the federal acquisition regulations, I believe, have to provide sufficient budgeting to account for optional work if it's implemented. However, it's not guaranteed to the contractor bidding on the work. that the option will be implemented. And so I think it actually accentuates the point that we're making here, which is that remedial action budgets should account for uncertainties when the scope or the information related to the scope is somewhat uncertain, because when you get to the remedial action contracting, you know, if there's optional work to do things that may or may not be uncertain, the budget certainly has to account for it, to, again, per the federal acquisition regulations, as I understand them.
Okay. Okay, and then we'll take one other question here. There were a few sort of comments about this type of skill set and where it might be found for a federal government to sort of tap into these cost risk skill sets, because it doesn't seem like this is something you can task a contractor to do, given the IGE element of it. So I don't know if you can comment or reflect on where this type of assistance or skill set might be found to do these types of risk analyses.
So it is a good point that when you talk truly about budgeting and about independent government cost estimate, contractors are barred from specifically being involved in that work. However, information can be used independent of that, such as these supplemental analyses can be performed under contract with consultants that have the expertise and used in consideration of the budgeting. I'll make a point here. Everything we presented here with respect to the actual budget that the federal agencies had in doing this work, I have no direct knowledge of. However, with things that are publicly available, like the records of decision, you know, remedial alternative cost estimates and feasibility study, you know, me as a contractor or a consultant, you know, can do theoretical projections of, you know, cost risk or other impacts from changing scope on what's publicly available, and then the federal agency can take that and use that information in budgeting. Certainly, certain federal agencies have cost experts and cost expertise, maybe more so than other agencies. For instance, the Army Corps of Engineers has centers of expertise related to cost estimating that can be tapped on. Department of Energy certainly has an organization within their department that has cost expertise. So I guess I would say, you know, from the federal agency representative perspective, you should be able to reach out to an agency with that expertise, either directly within your agency or through an interagency or intergovernmental agreement, to get expertise on the actual budgeting side. But certainly you can have consultants take what is publicly available or available that isn't barred by the FAR from being available to consultants, and have them do analyses to help aid in that decision. Hopefully that answers that question.
Excellent, thank you. I think at this point we'll go ahead and carry on with the presentation, but remember, those questions and comments can continue to be submitted through the Q&A window. We'll pause again in a little bit to carry on our Q&A segment.
Great, so we're going to continue the presentation of supplemental analysis tools, and this is with the cost estimate risk analysis, or CERA, as you heard earlier. So cost estimate risk analyses, what really are they? What they are is a quantitative means of numerically analyzing the effects of project risks on project costs. And I guess I'll make a side point that there's an additional element that I'll present in a couple slides about project schedule. You can analyze the effects of project schedule on the project cost as well. The way you do that is you can do a quantitative approach with Monte Carlo analysis simulations to reflect the effects of project risk and cost estimate uncertainties on that project cost. Those results will depict the overall cost impacts of project risk at various levels of statistical confidence for the base estimate. So the base estimate is really the estimate that you're performing the analysis on. Typically, as we've talked about in this presentation, that would be your ROD cost estimate or other cost estimate that was used as a basis for budgeting. That ROD remedy selection cost estimate, you know, was originally used, but you can also use remedial action estimates from the remedial design process if they're available to also do this process. And cost estimate risk analyses are really ideal for projects that have what I'll call a sufficient development of the scope and quantities relative to the remedy selection cost estimates, or remedial action cost estimates that have been developed that have, you know, more sufficient scope development and quantity development. And that, and the reason is when you do a cost estimate risk analysis, you're wanting to evaluate individual project risk numerically. So while you can perform on estimates that have a lower level of definition, it's a little more difficult to do so. One thing I'll point out, and again, this will be talked about a little later in the presentation, a basis of estimate document greatly aids in the understanding the uncertainties and assumptions made for costs in the base estimate. Again, we'll present that in a few slides. Again, I'm not going to go back over this information as the Bay had provided it in the previous case study, but again, the Gilt Edge Mine Superfund site is also a site where we did a cost estimate risk analysis during, I guess I'll point out there was two done, one during the feasibility study process prior to remedy selection, and then one that was done during the initial phases of design prior to remedial action implementation. And they touched on this. It's a little bit interesting in that it's a fund lead site, but there was enforcement settlement that partially funded the remedy. So you have a mix of perspectives because of the different funding streams. And one thing I'll point out is that Risk Strategics LLC is a firm that specializes in cost estimate risk analyses and project risk, and they assisted the project team during the initial phases of design with this cost estimate risk analysis. So this is output from that cost estimate risk analysis, and one thing I'll say about it is the process starts by doing a project risk registry. You have the team sit down. They identify what they consider to be project risk. There's a lot to this, so I didn't present it, but you identify categories of project risks, you know, what those specific risks are, and then you evaluate as a project team what is the likelihood of this risk occurring and also what is the consequence of if that risk were to occur. And based on that, you assign it a risk priority, and what you'll see on the right side of the screen is this risk priority summary. And so the ones in red are high risks, and I won't read all this, but there was 15 risks in this process identified as high, 13 is moderate, and 9 is low, for a total of 37 project risks identified that were analyzed using the Monte Carlo simulation. And this table shows the contribution of each risk to overall project risk. And the point I wanted to make here, there's a number of identified ones, but the highest one at 22.6% is unknown procurement strategy, and the third highest one is budget constraints at 15.3%. And the point being that those are ones that you wouldn't typically directly evaluate in a remedial action cost estimate or, you know, a feasibility study cost estimate used in a ROD. And so, you know, just taking those estimates without adjustment and developing a remedial action budget would be problematic because we're showing it's, you know, some of the highest risks for this particular project. Some of these other ones like volumes and diesel costs and other things would have been potentially directly evaluated in the estimate. And then this is what the, after evaluating those risks and putting in the Monte Carlo simulation, this is the output that you get. This table on the left shows various levels of statistical confidence, and I'll explain that in a minute, and then the resulting cost forecast that comes from that, including contingency and separately without contingency, and then how much contingency would have to be increased or decreased to meet that confidence level. I'll point out here for the intermediate remedial action cost estimate that was produced, and this was, again, I think in 2011, something like that, the cost estimate for that earthwork was almost $56 million, and that excluded contingency. So when you look at that over here in terms of statistical cost levels, you know, we fell relatively low within that confidence level, again, because some of the project risk can't be, you know, directly quantified in an estimate that's just looking at, you know, anticipated and known scope and quantities. What statistical confidence level means, just so you know, is at 100% statistical confidence level, given the risks that were identified, you can fully account for increase in project costs to account for that risk. Similarly, at 0%, you wouldn't be able to account for any of them, and you would be severely under budgeted. And again, our cost estimate, including contingency, was at $55 million, so you can see it was somewhat on the low end of the statistical confidence level. That's not necessarily a failure of that estimate. It just shows that when you're dealing with project risks and uncertainties related to them, one particular tool can't do it all. One thing I'll point out about this, and we'll touch on it again in a later slide, is where do you assess how you want a budget to include this cost risk when you're doing a remedial action budget. There is no set number you pick. It depends on stakeholder tolerance and the ability to budget. Guidance for federal agencies is that you would usually budget at 80% statistical confidence level. And you can see for this project that would have equated to somewhere in the neighborhood of $72 million to $75 million, as opposed to using the cost estimate from the design process of just under $56 million. A big difference. But you may use more or less depending on, again, your ability to budget and your risk tolerance. You can see that it would be almost impossible to fund at 100% statistical confidence level, at least on this project, where you're creeping upwards of $100 million under that process. Again, the key takeaway is that that wasn't directly costed. So if you would have used the cost estimate from the intermediate remedial action phase of design for budgeting, then there's a likelihood that the budget would have been exceeded. And that's why this SARA process is very helpful. This is another case study. This is the Olivia Asbestos Superfund site in Montana. And we list operable units 4 through 8. There are other operable units, some of which are PRP-led. These particular operable units were funded using an enforcement settlement prior to implementation. So the implementation is being led by the federal government through a fund that was established, but that it's not truly led by the potentially responsible parties. The scope of this action was removal of contaminated soil and building materials within the towns of Libby, Montana, and Troy, Montana, to meet the cleanup criteria, and then on-site disposal of those materials. Whether that was within the Lincoln County landfill or within the operable unit that contained the former vermiculite mine that originally generated the materials that posed the risk. O&M responsibilities are borne by the state of Montana as well as the city and county governments. And again, during this remedial design phase, or right at the beginning, during remedy selection and remedial design phase, Risk Strategics LLC assisted the project team in analyzing the risk from the remedy selection. So somewhat a little bit of a different presentation, but the same concept as before. We have the risk severity levels, the number of risks, their contribution to risk. Again, we tend to focus on the high ones. Those either have high consequence, high likelihood, or both in terms of if that risk were to occur. And you also look at the moderate ones. You can see that that's almost half of the risk, looked at within the cost estimate risk analysis. The thing to point out here is when you look at the risk, certainly you expect construction risk. I think most of us involved in remedial action construction feel that construction poses a lot of the risk. But what's really interesting is look at the external risks and institutional controls processes. Together, they totaled almost as many as the construction risk, and almost as much as a percent of the total as the construction risk. And the point being, what are external risks? Well, they're really risks related to funding streams and also unforeseen market conditions, meaning like, for instance, increase in the price of oil that translates to fuel costs. that's not something you typically control within, you know, a direct construction cost estimate you might be performing as part of remedial design, or, you know, a cost estimate for alternative in a record of decision. Similar to these institutional control processes, wasn't necessarily the implementation of an institutional control, which is, again, an administrative or legal approach. It was the complications related to agencies within that process and performing the institutional control. So, again, that's typically not accounted for in a remedial action cost estimate. So the key takeaway, you know, with those risks, they weren't directly related to the construction activities, and because of that, they didn't get captured in those estimates. So again, this is a graph similar to what you saw before, a little bit different presentation, but again, you focus on the statistical confidence level and then how that impacts, how those impacts relate to the risk in terms of a project cost. So, you know, on this project, I guess I'll point out that there were two remedies selected. One was for soil and one was for building materials, with a total cost with the contingency of $52, $53 million. So one thing I guess to point out is the statistical confidence level of the estimate that was performed matched the real-world conditions a little better. I will say there were reasons for that, including a lot of work that had been done during using removal authority prior to doing the site-wide feasibility study and remedial action. So there was good information on what costs typically were. That helped in the statistical confidence level of the base estimate, which was, again, the estimate provided in the ROD. So, you know, one thing to point out here, though, again, is depending on your confidence level, again, if you were to pick the 80% typically recommended for federal agencies, using that ROD cost would have slightly under budgeted it. And then again, you see this extreme tail once you get it to around the 95% confidence level, where you could have a significant increase, you know, close again to $100 million to be fully sure you could address all project risks. So again, it's just another illustration of, in this case, you could maybe be used the ROD cost estimate and been pretty close in budgeting, but you would have underrun it a little bit. And, you know, especially if you wanted to account for additional project risk, which in this case included funding streams, it could have been quite a bit lower. Again, the funding streams matter because if you don't get the funding when you need it, the price of doing the work later goes up. And then I just wanted to point this out real quickly because I know we're going to be getting short on time. You can also do this for schedule risk. I won't go into this, but, you know, the feasibility study, which translated the ROD, was 4 years of completion, and the risk analysis showed it could be up to 8 years. And, again, if you delay the action, price of materials and other things tend to go up over time due to inflation. So running a schedule risk analysis with the cost risk analysis can be extremely helpful for projects that may have sensitivities with the duration of construction. Key takeaways, I'll just touch real quick. This allows agencies, based on their risk tolerances, again, they differ in risk tolerance, to select a project cost at a specific confidence level given the project risk. The guidance generally recommends budgeting at the 80% level of statistical confidence, but that is guidance. And because these are conducted early in the RD process, it can allow an agency to consider an adequate amount of additional budgeting given the project their uncertainty and risk. With that, I'll turn it back over to Abhay Sanadne to go over basis of estimate.
Thank you, Gary. Moving on to the third supplemental analysis or cost tool, the basis of estimate document. For me personally, this is the most important piece of any estimate, as described by the Association of Advancement of Cost Engineering, AACE International's Recommended Practice number 34R05. The basis of estimate is the one document or deliverable that defines the scope of the project and ultimately becomes the basis for change management. A typical BOD document includes all these topics and contents, I'm not going to go into over each of the topic, but for example, the methodology, this should include documentation of the use of cost resources, historical data, and project benchmarking. The other topic, I'll just go quickly over, the cost estimate classification. Estimate classification should be identified using the ASCE's International Recommended Practice 17R97 or the ASTM International Publication number E2516-11. This defines the estimate class and the expected accuracy range. So moving forward, the key takeaway is cost estimate without a BOE document can lead to subjective interpretation of the estimate based on perspectives rather than agreed to assumptions or facts. So when the BOE document is prepared correctly, it will help one understand and assess the estimate independent of any other supporting documentation. It will state the purpose of the estimate clearly and concisely. It will state the project scope, pricing basis, allowances, assumptions, exclusions, cost fix, risks, and opportunities, and any deviations from standard practices. And it will document a record of pertinent communications that have occurred and agreements that have been made between the estimator and other project stakeholders. The important key points that should be considered during the BOE document preparation. The first needs to be complete but be concise. Document the overall project scope. Detail is always good, but be careful if it's too long or wordy, it won't be read. Be able to support your facts and findings in the document. Identify estimating team members so they may be able to answer questions regarding the estimate if the estimate primary estimator is not available. Provide a record of key communications made during estimate preparation. The BOE document should provide the information necessary for another estimator to replicate the estimated cost. Identify other projects that were referenced. History truly does repeat itself where projects are concerned. So references should be provided. Develop the BOE while the estimate isn't prepared. It is always easier to record your facts and findings while they are fresh in your mind. And always remember, for many reviewers, the BOE is the only document used to judge the quality of the estimate. And the most important is the quality assurance and quality control reviews to determine whether an estimate is comprehensive. This step also infuses quality assurance practices into the cost estimate. And the key takeaway is the BOE document is the document that is used to judge the adequacy and quality of the estimate. Without it, adequacy and quality of the estimate is subjective.
So at this point, we're wrapping up our presentation. We did want to give some acknowledgments. It's often difficult when you're involved in, project costs and budgeting, to want to share your lessons learned, whether they're good or bad, because it's just a difficult subject and is often highly scrutinized over, other parameters and the success of a project. So, certainly the projects that we list up there, whether it's EPA, state agencies, other agencies involved, you know, we really appreciate their willingness to share this information and provide you all with some insight on how we all as an industry can improve in these practices. And then I also want to give a special thanks to EPA's CLUIN staff for helping facilitate this, as well as SAME Metro Denver Post, which worked with us for the DCHWS West Conference. And then again, Risk Strategics LLC and being willing to present their information on cost and schedule risk analyses. So again, appreciate the time. And at this point, we do have our contact information up there, and it will be available later in case you have more detailed questions or other questions that can't be answered within the time frame. And at this point, I'll turn it back over to the EPA moderators. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. So we're going to switch over to a few more questions here in the time that we have remaining. And the first one that I'll take is actually referencing some of your case studies. So the attendee noted that in your case studies, were the higher RD costs calculated based on net present value, or was funding assumed to come out annually from operating budgets? For example, they just wanted to know, were the costs assuming escrow accounts were set up, or were they paid annually by the responsible party?
Well, so it's an interesting question because, again, it depends on the particular project and how it's funded. You know, if it's a responsible party involved, typically they fund those directly through, you know, whatever enforcement agreement there is, and there's reimbursement if somebody else is doing it. You know, if it's fund lead where it's, you know, federal agency using congressional appropriations, it comes from a separate funding stream, than typically what the actual construction or remedial action costs come from. So it really does vary depending on the project and its funding stream. So I can't give one-size-fits-all answers. What I would say is when we include remedial design costs in, for instance, a feasibility study cost estimate or a record of decision remedy selection cost estimate, that's a percentage indicated by the guidance that's applied to the costs that are indicated for the capital construction costs. To account for whoever's funding it. So that's where those numbers come from when you're doing remedy selection cost estimate.
Okay. And another question about cost risk analysis. When you wind up identifying technical risks, for example, a waste increase, do you find that your client will address that risk by increasing their RA budget and then the contracting mechanisms to address the risk? Or do they wind up investing more time and costs in the remedial design to try to reduce or mitigate the risk, thereby increasing confidence in their overall cost estimate?
So that's an interesting question as well, because I think, you know, we go into the process assuming that the record of decision in terms of what the scope is indicated would be the way you address it, and that you would somehow find, you know, additional money and apply a contingency in your budgeting to account for that. The reality is remedial action budgets are shrinking. There's more scrutiny at, you know, all levels on funding these kind of projects. It's very difficult to get Congress to appropriate money for it. And even responsible parties, you know, don't always have the funds to fund these things. So I have seen in practice that causes, when you determine this through a cost estimate risk analysis, it does cause a relook at the scope of the alternatives, and sometimes results in a post-rod change like an ESD, as you saw with the Gilt Edge example. I guess I would also point out, and we didn't get into it in this presentation, there is a process in remedial design called value engineering where an independent group of people come in and look at a design and see if there's ways to cut costs, you know, given the scope that was assumed in the design. So that's another way that can affect budgeting. But I guess the point is I've seen it both ways, and but the trend has been more to reevaluate the scope as opposed to provide more funding to do the same scope that was assumed.
Okay. And when we're looking at some of those risks diagrams that you were showing, one of the participants asks, how do you decide the bright lines between high, moderate, and low risk severity?
So that's a good question, and unfortunately with the time constraints, I couldn't go through the full process, but there's a matrix that has on the y-axis, you know, the likelihood of something occurring, and the other, the consequence, and so it's a two-dimensional matrix, and so some risk may be very likely to occur but have relatively low consequence, so they fall in the low category. And conversely, if you have one that's very likely to occur and has very high consequence in terms of cost impact, it would be in the very high category. But you do get this sort of zone where it's somewhat subjective. Is it really moderate or high? And you just work with the project team to assess that particular project risk and determine whether it falls as moderate or high, for instance. There are rules of thumb with respect to the various different risk categories as to what you should consider as moderate and high, but it is rules of thumb. So it's really working with the team, and sometimes it's somewhat of a subjective determination. In the end, you look at both high and moderate risk. So in the end, it typically doesn't matter a lot in the analysis whether it's right on the borderline of those two. Hopefully that answered the question.
Okay. All right, let's take one more. And this question was asking about your cost estimate analyses. Did you perform all of those cost estimate risk analyses with Monte Carlo?
So our risk consultant, Risk Strategics, used a software package that used a Monte Carlo type analysis. So I guess I should explain Monte Carlo analyses aren't unique to cost risk analysis. They're used in other venues for statistical analyses. It's basically putting variables in an equation and running them a thousand times or a million times to see what the outcomes are. Does it land in the more typical range or the more outlier range, and then you get that output. So I can't speak to Risk Strategics exactly what software package they use, but they did use one that incorporates the Monte Carlo type analyses. And I could actually find out that information later. It's in the reports. But in a very simple way, you could do it with Excel or another spreadsheet-based program. There are different ways to do Monte Carlo analyses with different software packages.
Okay. All right. Well, I think with the time that we have remaining, we'll probably close out our Q&A segment here. But I want to thank both of you for spending time with us and sharing your expertise. And, Kate, are you still with us on the lines for some closing reminders?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So, Kate, if you can take just a moment, we just wanted to remind the audience of just a few things. And so while those materials are up, of course, as you said, this has been an ongoing series. And, yes, this was number 6 so far in your series. So the sessions are available for on-demand playback through CLUIN. And the thing, though, that I wanted to have you highlight the audience is some of those future webinars that are coming up.
Yes, thank you, Jean. So what I'd like to just reiterate is we have 2 webinars on the schedule, one in April, which is going to be a presentation on sub-steam thermal remediation, sub-temperature thermal remediation. So a different spin on thermal remediation, which we're seeing a lot at Superfund sites. So if you're interested in hearing about a case study and the results of a pilot study using that thermal technology, I encourage you to sign up for the Wednesday, April 6th webinar. In addition, we have a webinar on integrating resiliency and sustainability into feasibility studies, design, construction, and operation and maintenance, compilation of case studies. That will be our May webinar. The registration should be open by the end of the month, so I encourage you to check in on CLUIN, review TechDirect if you're on the mailing list, and sign up for that if you're interested when it comes out. So with that, Jean, I will turn it to you for closing.
All right, thanks so very much. So just a few quick reminders, and then we'll go ahead and let everyone go for the day. So I encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org if you're interested in learning more about our resources on hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. We also have a free monthly newsletter that Kate was just referencing, Tech Direct. I send it out on the first of each month, and we always highlight free internet seminars like today's, as well as new web resources, websites, training, conferences, or other things, again, in that arena. So you can feel free to sign up for that free newsletter at the URL provided. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation content, we do have those available for download. That's on the seminar resources or links page. If you visit the seminar homepage, you'll see tabs for that along the top. But I've included it on the windows in the webinar room as well. So if you look under related URLs, you can scroll through that list, click on the link of interest to select it, and then press the Browse To button to open it up. If you happen to be watching the recorded version, those links still work in that window, so you can click on them and open them up to access materials. We do have contact information for presenters and organizers there as well, and I will ask each of you to fill out a brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in how we covered the materials as well as the materials that were presented. One of the most frequent questions I get is if we offer CEUs or PDHs. While we don't issue those types of credit hours, we can provide you with the participation certificate that many attendees are able to use to document their attendance for credit purposes. So the only way to get one of those certificates is to fill out our brief online feedback form. When you do that, please be sure to check the box at the bottom certifying you were there for the whole session, and make sure your email address is entered correctly on that form. Once you do that, when you hit the submit button, you should immediately see a window pop up where you can download or print out the certificate. We should also email a copy of it to you for your own records. Sometimes those emails get stuck in spam or junk filters, so I encourage you to download it or print it right from that pop-up window. If you happened to participate in a group from a conference room, everybody in that room can fill out the feedback form, even if they didn't register individually. So I'd ask the person who set the room up, please copy that seminar feedback URL and share it with your coworkers who joined you so they can share their own feedback to get their own certificate. And guess what? Those of you who stayed through to the very end of the recorded version, you can still follow those links to the feedback form. You can still share feedback based off the archive replay and get a certificate based off of that. So with that, I will echo thanks again to those of you who joined us for our session. It was recorded, and in about 1 to 2 weeks, you'll get an automatic email from me with instructions on how to replay today's session. So thank you again so very much for joining us. This will be the formal conclusion of our broadcast.